Let's start. Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the UN Information Service. Today is Tuesday, 19th of August, and we will start immediately by reminding everyone that today the international community comes together to celebrate, commemorate, and remember humanitarian workers that risk their life every day to carry out their extremely important work. I will start by reading you the message of the Secretary General, and then we will hear from our colleagues on this day. The Secretary General said, humanitarian workers are the last lifeline for over 300 million people caught in conflict or disaster. Yet, funding for that lifeline is drying up. And those who provide humanitarian aid are increasingly under attack. Last year, at least 398 workers, a record high, were killed across the world, from Gaza to Sudan to Myanmar and beyond. International law is clear. Humanitarians must be respected and protected. They can never be a target. This rule is non-negotiable and has been binding on all parties to conflict, always and everywhere. Yet, red lines are crossed with impunity. Governments have pledged action, and the Security Council has laid out a path to protect humanitarians and their life-saving work. The rules and tools exist. What is missing is political will and moral courage. On this World Humanitarian Day, says the Secretary General, let's honor the fallen with action to protect every day, every aid worker, and invest in their safety, to stop the lies that cost lives, to strengthen accountability and bring perpetrators to justice, to end arms flows to parties that violate international law. Together, let us say in one voice, an attack on humanitarians is an attack on humanity. And let's hashtag act for humanity. And this concludes the work of the Secretary General, the statement of the Secretary General. And on this subject, I'd like to give the floor now to Jens for OCHA, the organization that brings together and coordinates all this very important work. Jens.
Yeah, thank you very much, Alessandra. Let me read my bit here on World Humanitarian Day. Today is World Humanitarian Day, and that brings a lot of mixed emotions for people in the humanitarian community and beyond, as it means different things to different people. First, on behalf of OCHA, I want to honor every humanitarian worker we have lost to violence in the past year and all the years before that, and say that our thoughts are with the family members, friends, and colleagues who are left grieving. It shouldn't be this way, but it is. It's bad, and it's getting worse. Today's grim statistic is that last year, 2024, a shocking number of aid workers were killed, and we have seen a 31% increase compared to the previous year, 2023, a third more than the year before. Most of those killed were national staff serving in their home communities, and the numbers are driven up by the relentless conflict in Gaza, where more than 180 humanitarian workers were killed last year, and many more if you count from the beginning of the war, and in Sudan, where 60 were killed last year. Tragically, the first 8 months of this year show no sign that this disturbing trend is reversing. As of mid-August, 265 aid workers have been killed, and that's according to provisional data, and I stress it's provisional data from the aid worker security database that we work with every year on this occasion. This must be a wake-up call to the world. People representing the best of humanity, trying to help others, are being killed in record numbers, and some of them in cold blood. Attacks on this scale, with no accountability, cannot be ignored year after year. So our campaign this year, as mentioned, and everyone can engage using the hashtag #ActForHumanity, is very clear in its message to people with power and influence. Respect the rules of war, protect humanitarians and civilians, and call time on impunity. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jens. Let's move on to OHCHR, who also has a message on this important day.
Good morning, everyone. Today, as we mark World Humanitarian Day, the High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, pays tribute to the many human rights defenders around the world who risk their lives and who stand up for human rights. He says, "We will never stop insisting that governments work together to ensure that they provide full humanitarian access to people in need and that there is accountability for grave violations of international human rights violations and violations of international humanitarian law. Humanitarian workers and UN personnel must be protected." Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tamin. And I give the floor now to Christian for WHO, also on this matter.
Thank you all very much, yes, to share my or our bit on World Humanitarian Day. As conflicts become more intense, complex, and protracted globally, attacks on healthcare, that's facilities, health workers, infrastructure, transportation, and all related services. Humanitarian civilians and civilian infrastructure have become increasingly common, often in clear violation of international laws. Attacks are happening everywhere. Since the beginning of this year, WHO has verified 821 attacks on health across all regions of the world, with 1,121 deaths and 645 injuries among health workers and patients across 16 countries or territories. So far this year, the five countries reporting the highest numbers of attacks are, although this should by no means a comparison, let's be clear, every single attack on health is one too many. Ukraine, 325 attacks reported with 10 deaths and 114 injuries. OPT, 304 attacks with 61 deaths and 165 injuries. The DRC, 38 attacks with no deaths and 8 injuries. Sudan, 38 attacks with 933 deaths and 148 injuries. And last but not least, Myanmar with 33 attacks with 51 deaths and 90 injuries. Violence involving the use of heavy weapons, tanks, missiles, bombs, there are 471. Obstructions to the delivery of healthcare, 255. Violence with individual weapons, 144. And the use of psychological violence, 142, were the most frequent types of attacks so far this year. In 2025, health facilities were the most frequently affected resource. Of the 821 attacks reported in our system, a majority of incidents affected health facilities, followed by health workers and patients. Last year, in 2024, 1,647 attacks on healthcare have been reported from 16 countries or territories, with nearly 1,000 deaths and 1,779 injuries. WHO defines an attack on health as any act of verbal or physical violence or obstruction or threat of violence that interferes with the availability, access, and delivery of curative and/or preventive health services during emergencies. Attacks on health not only kill and maim, but also deprive people of urgently needed care, endanger healthcare providers, undermine health systems, disrupt access to health services when people need it the most. All actors have a role to play to stop attacks on health and take accountable actions in legal, operational, and policy measures to prevent and protect against attacks and ensure the right to health for all. WHO calls on all relevant parties in conflicts to actively protect and respect healthcare, ensuring safe and continued delivery of healthcare and access to healthcare free from violence, threat, or fear. The escalating humanitarian needs occurring at a time of severe funding cuts. This makes sustained and diversified support from member states and other stakeholders more critical than ever to uphold humanitarian principles and ensure life-saving aid reaches those in need, including for health. And yes, these were a lot of figures. The notes will be sent.
Thank you very much, Christian. And before opening the floor to question, if any, on this matter, I would like to remind everyone that the Geneva community will commemorate World Humanitarian Day with a solemn ceremony that will be held at 4 p.m. today. That's going to be, as usual, outside the Human Rights and Alliance of Civilization room, room 20. A lot of people will be there and will speak, including the Director General of UN Geneva, Tom Fletcher, Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, Nada Al-Nashif, the Deputy High Commissioner for Human Rights. We will also hear from Abdul Karim Hashim Mustafa, the Permanent Representative of the Republic of Iraq, where the attack killed 22 years ago so many UN officers and local workers. We will also hear from Mr. Dafer, Yunis Al-Husseini, a human rights officer who was there on the 19th August 2003 and who survived the terrorist attack against the UN mission in Baghdad. And we will hear from Laura Johnson, the Executive Secretary of the UN Geneva Staff Council. And of course, the event will be webcast on Web TV. So I'll open the floor to question now, if there is any, on World Humanitarian Day. Robin.
Thank you. Good morning. Are people ever brought to justice for these crimes, for these killings? And if so, what is the actual pathway for achieving justice? Is it entirely reliant on the state where these killings take place? Because a lot of them, it seems from the figures, tend to happen at the hands of state actors.
Jens or Tamina, I don't know.
Yeah, I will leave it with Tamina actually on the processes of these things. But look, the attack in Baghdad, nobody has ever been held to account on that, right? 22-23 years ago. And that kind of says everything, because we see very, very few, if any. Off the top of my head, I can't recall anyone who has ever been brought actually to justice for any of these attacks.
Exactly what the Secretary General is asking for in his statement. I mean.
Yes, thank you for that question. Of course, the primary obligation is that of the state concerned when it comes to such attacks on humanitarian workers. But also there is universal jurisdiction. So where the state concerned is unable or unwilling to proceed with accountability measures, other states can use the principle of universal jurisdiction. So we call on all states to take their responsibility to do what they can within their jurisdiction in order to ensure justice and accountability. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other question? Let me look at the platform. I don't see any hand up. Yes, Emma.
Just on the numbers, Jens, that you mentioned at the beginning, how is 2025 shaping up historically? Has there ever been a year that's been this bad for the number of humanitarians killed? I realize we're still in August, but to date.
Yeah, I can't tell you because I can't truthfully tell you because it goes through quite a rigorous verification process. That's why we release the numbers, the record numbers for 2024 now, right? Because there is a process. So we are as sure as we possibly can be that this is a truthful picture of what's going on. But with, what did I say, 265 as of mid-August, you know, that doesn't look like the trend is bending in the right way. So, of course, we are very concerned. That's why I think this World Humanitarian Day this year is particularly important. It really, really is, because it is catastrophic, and the trend is going right the opposite direction of what it should.
Other questions? on the platform? No, I don't see any. So thank you very much. I really hope we'll see you this afternoon at 4 o'clock in front of room 20. Just wanted to also remind everybody, because that's also somehow connected to the event in Baghdad 22 years ago, that the 21st of August is International Day of Remembrance and Tribute to the Victims of Terrorism, of course, including those who lost their lives, who were wounded in the Baghdad attack, and so many others after this and before. Thank you, Jens. And Christian, you stay with us because I think you have an announcement at the end, but I'd like now to give the floor to Tamin, who is going to brief us on the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory, and in particular, Marwan Barghouti.
Thank you again, Alessandra. Video footage showing Israeli National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir berating and taunting Palestinian leader Marwan al-Barghouti face-to-face inside an Israeli jail is unacceptable. The minister's behavior and the publication of the footage constitute an attack on Barghouti's dignity. International law requires that all those in detention be treated humanely, with dignity, and their human rights respected and protected. Such conduct by the minister responsible for the Israeli prison service may encourage violence against Palestinian detainees, enabling human rights violations in Israeli detention facilities. Meanwhile, in Gaza, the Israeli army has intensified its attacks in the north of the Strip. The Israeli military has also continued to issue displacement orders for Palestinians, including those in Gaza City, telling them to move to Al-Mawasi area, even as strikes on this area continue. On the 16th and the 17th of August, we recorded 5 attacks on tents of internally displaced people in Al-Mawasi area, killing at least 9 people. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians displaced to Al-Mawasi have little or no access to essential services and supplies, including food, water, electricity, and tents. The risk of starvation is everywhere in Gaza. This is a direct result of the Israeli government's policy of blocking humanitarian aid. In the past few weeks, Israeli authorities have only allowed aid to enter in quantities that remain far below what would be required to avert widespread starvation. Reaching the meager supplies available can be a deadly pursuit. Since the 27th of May and up until the 17th of August, we have documented that 1,857 Palestinians were killed while seeking food, including 1,021 killed in the vicinity of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation sites, and 836 killed on the routes of supply trucks. Most of these killings appear to have been committed by the Israeli military. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tamin. Let me go now to the questions in the room. Yes, Emma?
I had a couple of questions on Gaza. If I might pose one to Jens as well, if possible, that would be great. But
he can come back if,
if you don't mind, Jens. And just for you, Tamin, you mentioned the attacks on Al-Mawasi, where people are sheltering. So it's a question on shelter. There haven't been any supplies allowed into Gaza for many months, for shelter equipment, tents, and that sort of thing. What So what does that constitute? Is that a violation of some rights that people have to adequate shelter, given that there's supplies piling up on the other side of the border? Could you elaborate on that? And for Jens, if you don't mind, it's on shelter as well. I know that Israel has lifted the ban on shelter equipment, and I saw your statement last night, but can you say whether you know if any has been able to get in since then, and why? And why not? Thank you both.
Thank you, Emma. We have seen reports that some supplies are entering, and we have seen that there are some trucks entering with supplies. And when we talk about supplies, we're talking about partly humanitarian aid and partly commercial goods. Now, this is far below the amounts that are needed to avoid starvation. And of course, the use of starvation as a weapon of war is a war crime. And we continue to call on Israel to allow in aid in sufficient amounts for the population to be able to survive. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jens.
Yeah, thank you, Emma. What I can say is we cannot speak for other actors, but the United Nations and our partners have, as of last night, not been able to bring in shelter materials following the Israeli announcement. There's a set of impediments that still need to be addressed, including Israeli customs clearance.
Yep. And can I just get you to elaborate, because some people are estimating maybe a million more people being displaced if the Gaza City offensive goes ahead. If these supplies you mentioned can't get in a timely manner, where does that leave people in Gaza who've been displaced? Thank you.
We don't even need to look ahead of how possibly this could get worse. It has already gotten worse. As you know, shelter has been banned entry for about 5 months. And in that period, over 700,000 people have been displaced or re-displaced. What very often happens is that they have to leave their tents. They may have been provided with a tent, and then they're displaced again, and they have no possibility of taking a tent with them. So there are lots of things that are very challenging with these repeat displacement when you are trying to respond to people where they are, because they get displaced over and over and over again.
Other questions? Yes, Mohammed.
Thank you, Alessandra. My question for Tamin. Tamin, as you see on the report, the Israeli army approved the plan to occupy Gaza City. You already mentioned thousands of people are reported the feeling at the Gaza City in fear as a result of this decision. My question is, do you think this decision is the first step in Israeli plan to complete the control over all the Gaza? And what are the dangers of these decisions? Thank you.
Maybe, yeah, let me maybe start on this to say that the Secretary General remains concerned about the inflammatory statements that we are hearing for the Israeli military to capture additional territory in Gaza, as you are asking. Let me remind you that Security Council Resolution 2735, 2024, rejects any attempt at demographic or territorial change in the Gaza Strip, including any action that reduce the territory of Gaza. So the latest decisions that we have heard about are another dangerous escalation of the conflict, and we really want to underline and stress that there is no military solution to the armed conflict in Gaza or the broader Palestinian conflict in general, and we need to go back to the two-state solution.
Thank you, Alessandra. Thank you, Mohammed. Yeah, as Alessandra said, these plans have a huge risk for people, for civilians. There are risks of mass displacement and more and more killings and more misery that we have already seen in the Gaza Strip. And of course, among those who will be affected are the most vulnerable, people with disabilities, the injured, the children, women, many people who are unable to move the way they should be if they want to avoid all the risks that are entailed in such operations. Of course, we don't know whether this is a first step for a larger plan, but the High Commissioner has warned that this plan for a complete military takeover of the occupied Gaza Strip must be immediately halted because of these risks that we're talking about. Thank you.
Robin.
Jens, on shelter being banned from being taken into the Gaza Strip for 5 months, are you ever given a reason as to why that would be when you attempt to take these things in? If so, what are those reasons? Thank you.
Sometimes reasons are given to individual agencies, sometimes not, is my understanding. What we have seen in this conflict and in previous conflicts, by the way, is that it falls under dual use regime because of tent poles.
Emma?
Just to follow up on Robin's, just in this most recent phase, we've heard that it might be related to this Israeli registration process, the questions that they're asking aid agencies about Palestinian employees. Is that one of the impediments in the difficulties of getting shelter supplies in? Thank you.
It is an impediment, full stop. It is additional layers of bureaucracy which are put on top that seem designed not to facilitate fast entry of anything, but rather the opposite.
Okay, don't see other hands up in the room or on the platform. So thank you very much. Thanks, Tamin. You wanted to add something? No? It's okay. Thank you very much. So I'll give now the floor to Christian, who had one additional. Thanks, Jens, who had an additional announcement for us. Go ahead, Christian.
Yep, here we go. Thank you very much. So on Friday, 22 August, WHO and the World Meteorological Organization, WMO, will launch the Climate Change and Workplace Heat Stress Report and Guidance. This major new joint report and guidance warns that climate change-driven heat waves are taking a growing toll on health, especially among manual workers in agriculture, construction, and fisheries, and among vulnerable groups in low-income settings. An embargoed joint press conference will be held on Thursday, 21 August, at 1400 hours Geneva time. The report, the press release are available for early access, and experts from WHO and from WMO are available for interviews as well. The embargo will then lift at 8 o'clock Geneva time on Friday morning. An announcement has been sent. All related questions to the context there, please. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this announcement, Christian. Also on behalf of WMO, just Claire is also online if you have any question on this, either to Christian or Claire. I don't see any hand up. So thanks, Christian, for this, and Claire for being here. Moshe, I have only a few further announcements for you. First, on behalf of the Office of the Special Envoy for Syria, who asks me to inform you that the UN Special Envoy for Syria, Mr. Geir Pedersen, will brief the Security Council in an open session on Thursday at 10 a.m. New York time, so 4 p.m. Geneva. And as usual, his briefing remarks will be distributed after he speaks. The Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities is concluding this morning the review of their initial report of Kiribati. Tomorrow they will go to Maldives, and the other country to be examined will be Finland on the 21st of August and 22nd. The Conference on Disarmament is holding this morning a brief plenary meeting, which is the first under the presidency of Mexico. And we will announce further meetings when they come along. Just a few announcements for you. So, is there any other question or remarks? I don't see any. So thank you very much for following this briefing, and I hope to see you this afternoon at 4 o'clock in front of room 20. Thank you.